Accession number 19585, Reel 3.
This is Rupert Cooling Reel 2.
Yep.
Right, you said earlier on that the Wellington was an unforgiving, was a forgiving aeroplane. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me some of the sins you got up to?
As I said, it was heavy on the controls, I suppose, basically. It was underpowered initially with the Peggy engines. The Wellington, of course, spread over, I forget how many marks it was, but I flew the 1, the 1A, the 1C, the 3, and the 10, and each was better than its predecessor. And the 10 was a joy to fly, because you had the, not Centaurus, the Hercules engines, which were just hummed like Singer sewing machines. I flew the 10 in North Africa, where the climatic conditions were a bit more arduous because of temperatures. You had to watch things like cylinder head temperatures and so forth and so on. But we used to go out with we used to take something in that particular time. I remember taking 6,500 pounds in one load on an outside air temperature, which probably at takeoff time was about 28 degrees. So by the time I'd got up to about 1,000 feet, the cylinder heads, the collector ring on the front of the engines was growing a bright pink cherry red. It really was. It was a bit off-putting. And even then, when we went out over the coast and what have you, to try and get altitude was a bit difficult. So I shed one of the 500-pounders so that I could get up a bit higher. But apart from that, the Hercules engine was a delight. We used to fly out, and then by the time we were coming back half empty, or rather the bombs had gone and the fuel was sometimes, used to be able to bring the RPM down to just over 1,600. All you had to do was to keep it over 1,500 to keep the generator turning sufficiently to give you electrical power. And she just sighed through the air. It was lovely. And then you got back into the circuit and you got lined up and you got your pitch levers up and your flaps down and you set her at about 95 on the approach and you just put her into the landing attitude and just lowered her with the throttles, as you were saying earlier on. And you've got a winner every time. I mean, the ground was, well, there were no runways in North Africa. It was just baked earth and so forth and so on. So the ground was a bit rough. But she just used to settle like a bird on a nest. And she was a forgiving aeroplane. Instead, you just had total confidence in the aircraft. Utter and complete confidence. You knew that as long as she got that geodetic construction, 75% sound, she'd get you home. People used to come back with chunks knocked out. I've heard, because I never saw any of those, but I did see one flying once at a gunnery school, where the stitching had come loose on the fabric after the trailing edge. And the rear gunner was sitting there looking down a tube of fabric, rather like somebody pulling a sock off, because it had gone back, it had split either side of the fin and what have you. And it was flat, because I saw this thing, I saw this wimpy in the circuit, and I thought, God, that's half as long again as it should be. Where's the bit in the middle? And what had happened is the fabric had come loose. He was rather disconcerted when he landed. Thankful to be on the ground. But, I mean, that's the sort of thing that the Wellington would do. It would get you back. Like any aeroplane, if you were foolish with it, if you got bravado with it, if you tried to do... I mean, I've heard people say, oh, yes, you could barrel roll a Wellington without any trouble at all. And people did. People who were the test pilots and this sort of business who had the skills. But if you were bloody fool enough to try it when you'd only got about a couple of hundred hours, you were asking for trouble. She wouldn't forgive that. But if you treated the aeroplane with respect, recognizing that there were limits, the limits were published, your limits you could reach, you could perhaps go over them slightly, you were all right. But if you tried to do anything damn silly, believe you me, like any aeroplane, she'd bite, and probably bite hard.
What about centre of gravity movements when you've got a load of bombs on? I mean, was there a huge shift?
No.
Suppose you dropped the whole lot at once.
No.
You didn't have to do mad retrimming.
No, no, nothing like that at all. Actually, when we were in North Africa, we moved base. And in fact, we moved the entire unit in the aircraft themselves, which meant we were loading tents and ammunition boxes and you name it. Well, I don't think we carried bombs. But I know I took my ground crew and our own tent and everybody else's tent. And people were just stuffing it in, and there was no question of something forward, something aft, this, that, and the other. They bother at all. It might have been perhaps slightly strange, but it was certainly within limits. I never had any snags of that sort. The only thing, well, I'll tell you how forgiving she was. One of my first trips as a skipper, we took off for somewhere in Germany, God knows where, and climbed right out towards Orphan Ness, and I didn't seem to be able to get above 90 knots. And we were climbing desperately slowly, and I realised that there was something very odd. So I said, oh, well, this is no good. We can't get any altitude. We've got no speed. Let's go back. So I got back to base, did a circuit, still had the bombs on. I don't know what it would be, 12 250s, something like that, about 2,000 pounds with a... Was it? No, nearly 4,000, perhaps 4,000 pound of bombs on board. By that time, I suppose I might have got 60 or 80 hours in on Wellingtons. Came in, lined up, and started to come in, you know, the usual things. And the speed fell and fell and fell, and it fell off the clock. And the rate of climb indicator was showing that I was climbing at 1,000. It was, I will say, dusk. It was not dark. Showing that I was climbing at about 1,000 feet a minute. The aircraft felt all right. And I landed. And what had happened was that one of the fitters, in a moment of excess, had put Kilfrost paste over the pitot head. But I'd landed an aircraft with an almost full fuel load, an almost full bomb load, with an instrument panel which was US, with no reliable airspeed indicator, with no reliable rate of climb indicator. And I just landed, taxied it back, and took out another aeroplane.
Well, that 90 knots indicator, I mean, it's virtually the stalling speed of that aeroplane.
Well, it would have been that. Which was one of the things that caused me to question something. But when I think back on it, I thought, you bloody fool. Anybody in their right senses would have jettisoned the bombs. We were over the sea. Would have jettisoned the bombs, flown around for a couple of hours, although I grant you it sort of daylight dark on the hedge there, it would have been not a good idea to have landed in the dark. But to come in with the bloody bombs on board. It never crossed my mind to dump them. Because, I mean...
Was comment made by superior officers?
No. Oh, they just sort of said... they saw me next day when we got back, and they said, oh, we found out what was the matter. Somebody put Kilfrost paste over the pitot head. So they won't do that again. And I said, well, I'm very glad of that.
But, I mean, those bombs would have been had their primary fuses set, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, but they would have been dropped safe. See, you had a horseshoe which was over the fitted over the nose pistol, which prevented it rotating and arming the bomb, and the tail for that matter as well.
And they wouldn't have been released unless
the bomb aimer or navigator or somebody had armed the bombs with the switches, which merely sort of put a little hook through so that when the bomb fell away, the weight of the bomb withdrew the safety device. Otherwise, you just drop them, and that's it. But But, I mean, that's how forgiving a wimpy is. I was flying, quite literally, flying that aircraft by the seat of my pants, which is the one thing which is the quickest route to perdition that there is. When anybody says, well, I can fly this aircraft by the seat of my pants. But again, another incident which I can recall, which demonstrates how important it is to not fly by the seat. We were over Tunis one night. For some reason or other, we were later on the target. I think we'd had a minor snag. We got over there, and we were probably about the only one. And this was just before Tunis fell. And we were out coming up to Tunis docks. And a clip of shells went up off just beneath us. I mean, it really was. It was a crack, crack, crack. And I thought for a moment that we'd been hit. And I flew through the aircraft into a very steep turn. I literally, quite literally, threw it. This was a 10, I think it was. And we got away from the area. And I'd lost my sense of balance. And I was convinced that I was flying in a steep bank with one wing lower. But my instruments told me that I was flying straight and level. In fact, straight and level. I wasn't climbing. My speed was constant, my rate of climb indicator, and all the instruments saying straight and level. And I remember a flight sergeant at one of the courses I was at saying, always trust your instruments, particularly if they all tell you the same story. Never go for how you feel. And I was most unhappy and felt so... I was sort of sitting in the flight seat like that. And then somebody else dropped a stick of bombs just ahead of us and lit up a horizon. And all of a sudden, click, I was back in again. But if I had tried to fly by the seat of my pants instead of by my instruments, we'd have been in dead stuck. We really would have been.
Because G comes from all different directions.
It does indeed, it? Yes. Yeah, yes. But it is that you get this most disorientation because it was a dense black night. There was no horizon, no stars, nothing at all. There was obviously a layer of cloud over, and it was just that somebody dropped a stick of bombs further ahead of us and it lit up the coastline momentarily. Mm-hmm. And that was all it needed. It was just like switching on a light. All of a sudden your senses were in true orientation again. And it was an eerie sensation, and it was not one that I would enjoy repeating, but I remember and I think he could get at the time. Thank God for that training.
Can I go back to Huntington?
Yes.
How many ops did you do over Germany from there? I did
27 from Huntington. No, 28 from Huntington. I did one, what they call nickel, which was when I went back for my refresher course. I went to number 30 OTU at Hixson to be retrained, as it were, after an interval in training command, to be converted to the 3s and 10s. And we'd the last thing you did was what they called a nickel, which was dropping leaflets over northern France. And we went to, we dropped paper over Paris. Well, that was op number 29. I remember coming back, landing, and I'd married then, living out, and going up to my good wife, who's sort of opened one eye, and so I said, oh, all right. And I said, yes. And she said, where have you been? I said, Paris. And she said, Paris. She said, Paris? So I said, yes, we took some newspapers over for the French. And then I did 37 more in... 39 in North Africa, 27 at Huntington and one nickel. That's right, total 67.
So you completed a tour of Huntington, did you?
Yeah. Yes, because my tour finished at the end of September. They did a great big sweep. Anybody who was close to tour expired at the end of September went, because we'd been all through the Battle of Britain. The invasion threat, although we didn't know it, had been lifted because somebody had intercepted the ultra signals from what have you, that sort of stood down the airborne forces in Holland. And they said, you know, panic's dying down a bit. Let's have a complete sweep and get the new fresh blood in for the winter. And I just happened to be lucky to perhaps save one trip or something like that. I'd have been screened at 28 or 29 anyway, and I just did 27.
You told me a couple of sad stories earlier on. During your time on that tour, What was the attrition rate on yours?
Very low, very low. I think we lost six.
Really?
In the whole time that I was there from May to September. Actually, three flight commanders. Squadron Leader Pritchard, Squadron Leader Moneypenny, and Squadron Leader Hinks. Let's see, who else? As I say, Hewitt, Butler. Oh, and another one, Pilot Officer Wenklin. Yeah. Those were the six that got the chop on that one.
What do you put your survivability down to? The learning curve as you went up it? Or?
Partly, yeah, partly. Partly that, I think. Certainly the learning curve. Certainly luck. I don't know what else. God? Oh, no, people say, do you believe in God? I said, I was a pilot in Bomber Command. And lived. Doesn't mean to say I believe in religion.
No.
But I wonder if I've got it here. Somebody gave me something not long ago. Oh, dear.
It's all right. Do you want to...
No, it's all right. I thought the mic had fallen off. I was... But you realise that you never talked about... You might talk about your next leave, but you never talked about next month. And it was almost a tacit acceptance, which never was manifested more than the fact that you never look forward because you didn't know whether there was anything to look forward to. You might talk about what you're going to do tomorrow, or you reckon you might be going on leave next week. But in June, you didn't say, well, I hope I shall be home for Christmas. Or, you know, it'll be nice to do this, that, and the other. And I think this is reflected in letters as well. It is all immediate future rather than a longer distance future. Whereas we will talk about, shall we go on holiday in June or July? Or shall we do this? Or the family will say, well, of course, it's Father's Day. Are you going to come over to us? And this was a month ago. Never had anything like that because it was almost an acceptance that you might not have been there, and yet it wasn't. You were not aware of it. You lived from day to day.
Did you ever feel a need to release the tensions that were obviously built up?
Not really. No, no. All this business of roistering and what have you. A lot of it was bravado. I mean, bear in mind, a lot of us had been raised on the tales of the RFC and the wild drinking parties and all this sort of business. And there was a lot initially of thinking, well, we've got to live up to the example set us by our forebears. But there was no real... Well, there was always some mad sods, of course. There always are in anything. But there was no spontaneous, very little spontaneous over the top. At least not when I was there. Now, what it was like later in 1943 with the bomber stations in Yorkshire and Lincolnshire and wherever it was, where things were pretty rugged and you knew that you stood a 10% chance of finish your 30 ops, then I wouldn't know. But the people I was with, both in 9 Squadron and 142 Squadron, just quietly, I wouldn't say we drank more than was good for us. One or two of us were sort of thinking, God, you know, we've got to get up to 4 pints a night, otherwise we're not men. But after a while you found, well, you know, what's the point? You grew up. You grew up very fast. I don't recall a great deal of that. I mean, I was lucky that I got my woman early. We married in 1941. So I didn't have to go chasing skirt all over the place. Well, a lot of the fellas, of course, the attitude is, well, who the hell wants to die a virgin? And that's understandable. Yes, there was bound to that, but I suppose there's bound to be that anyway. I suppose it still applies, God willing. I hope it does, for heaven's sake. I wouldn't have thought that my children and grandchildren have ambitions to die a virgin. In fact, I know my children won't.
picking you up on this, you just said then you grow up, you grew up very rapidly. Now, when you were flying on these ops, you were sort of 20, 21,
yeah.
and the rest of your crew about the same age.
That's right, yeah. The old man in my second tour was 34, the navigator, and he did about 8 trips with us and cracked, and they sent him home.
Navigators tended to crack, didn't they, more than other flight crew members?
Yeah.
But you were a bunch of 6 youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
You were all really at the same level of experience, I suppose.
Pretty well, yeah.
And you all had to rely on each other's experience.
This was what I was talking about, the total bonding and trust. Because you had, the fact you had no option may have been relevant, I don't know. But the point was that you did, you had total trust, you had to have total, and the thing is that it's existed. My erstwhile bomb aimer, I had a letter from him 3 or 4 days ago. My rear gunner, as I say, died in February. My wireless operator died December 98. But we still exchange, still send his wife, his widow now, Christmas card. My navigator was finished up, as in fact, as a captain on BOAC one time. He died some long time ago, actually, but he lived life at both ends, as it were. He was the man who used to sit up all night playing cards. Wasn't a great drinker or anything like that, but he didn't look after himself. But again, we still exchange cards with his wife, and in fact, his wife has been seriously ill, and it was his daughter that wrote this Christmas to say that, mother, this, that, the other, and so forth. In other words, this keeps going, keeps going. Yeah. My first tour, I've lost one of them. I found out I've met or have accounted for all the crew. One of them is at Runnymede, my wireless operator. Jock Gilmore was shot down and is buried in Marseille. My rear gunner is buried in Apeldoorn. My second pilot I met in British Airways after the war, so I know he made it. But one gunner has eluded me, and I know that he was demobbed virtually the same day as I was in 1945 as a warrant officer with holding the DFC. But I've never been able to find him, and I've spoken to him, been interviewed by the BBC, and I've said, Rossiter, if you're out there, get in touch. Not a sign.
Because they've got this Channel 4, haven't they?
Tried all known. Of course, he could well be dead now. I mean, he was young Rossiter to us. Well, young Rossiter will be at least 79 now.
The other thing, keeping on this bonding thing and so on.
Yeah.
I remember interviewing flight engineer, and he was describing that once you've taken off and you're on your way to Germany, you're all in your own little cocoon.
That's right.
The others are all out there. You feel their slipstreams occasionally. And it's almost like an air crew as a committee.
Yeah.
You've got a certain amount of self-government and self-decision.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I would indeed. I would go even further to say that each individual in the crew experienced his own particular war. Because we were all in various commands. The rear gunner was 70 feet away down the back end in his tiny little cubicle down there. And all it was a disembodied voice over the intercom. The wireless operator had his headphones on and a mass of dials and couldn't see a damn thing. The navigator was in his cubicle. The bomb aimer was the only chap that I remember, and I would be standing here flying the aircraft and Bill would be standing next to me looking out of the window. And then would just disappear down. But when you came up to the target, I could see what was going around up there. Bill was looking straight down into it, watching it come up. The others couldn't see anything, except the rear gun, and he saw it when we were on our way out. So if you said, because Bill let me see his diary not long ago, and I didn't recognize some of the trips we did, because he saw them very differently to what I did. I remember he wrote one that we went to Naples and it was a very dicey do. I remember the Naples one that was a bit noisy, but I wouldn't have said it was that dicey, because we came in round the corner. We came in behind Vesuvius in the hope that that the Italians would not be able to see us, which was a forlorn hope, because they had guns on the side of Vesuvius as well. But it was...
Would you say that as a pilot, or pilot in command, that you've got an awful lot to preoccupy you, and therefore you're not as scared by what's happening outside your window?
I don't think you're ever scared once you're in the thick of it. That was the odd thing about it. The most awful time, not awful, awful in the sense of, you know, when George, whatever it was, looked round St. Paul's Cathedral for the first time and said, this is awful and artificial. In that sense, the most time that was the least attractive, when the time when you felt you had a ball of wet, warm dough in your guts, was between the time that your name went on the board and the time you got airborne. Once you were airborne and on your way, you were enjoying flying, you were what have you. When you came up to the target, you watched to see what was going on. Now, I'm talking now about overseas, not the bomber command, where the time on target was this, heading this, height this, and so forth. In North Africa, on our operations there, you were on your own, you were your own commander. You decided what height you would go in, what direction you would go in. And it used to be my policy, as I came up as far as I could, to see what was happening. And because there was a peculiar herd instinct. People would tend to go in at the same height. And you could see the flak bursting, say, at 8,000 or 9,000 feet or something like that, because everybody was up there. And if you were lying off, you think, fine, good. And you went in at 6. By the time the gunners realised that there was somebody coming in and the height had changed, they were not going to sort of go down to all the business of resetting their sights and their fuses and God knows what. They'd stick with the swarm up above. So you could whistle through relatively unscathed.
Another reason why you survived.
One of the reasons why you survived, yeah. Yeah. But that was the sort of stratagems that you learned from time to time. But again, luck plays an enormous amount a very big part. One particular trip which I've written, I had a fitter called Dave, I can't remember his other name, he finished up as a flight engineer with BOAC, who was desperate to fly on operations. And in fact, eventually he did become a flight engineer. But he was our engine fitter in North Africa. And he said he wanted to do a trip. And that time we were doing Pantelleria, which was 2.5 hours off the coast of Karawang, round trip. So one of my, I think the bomb aimer borrowed a May West and parachute and stuck it on board. And of course, Dave was there when we did all the start-up and so forth and so on. And he'd come in beside me whilst we ran up the engines just to make sure they were all right. And Shag Sword was the flight sergeant. And he might look in and sort of say, OK, and then he'd go on to the next aircraft.
That was a ground chief.
Yeah, that's right. So on this particular occasion, we decided that we would take Dave with us. Because instead of throwing him out when we dropped the ladder, we put him in the back, he could kit up, and we'd take him with us. And the fitter, the rigger, or armourer, or whatever it was, and the crew would cover for him. Oh, he's gone off for a cup of tea, or he's gone off for a pee, or something like that. So we went to Pantelleria, and as Dave was with us, I said, well, you know, we'll go round, we'll come in a different direction. So we went round the island, and as we were coming up to the island, we saw Wellington go down in flames. So, well, that's a bit unfriendly. Anyhow, we went round the island, came in, we bombed Pantelleria, and then set course for home, and then text in the back said, there's another kite going down in flames. And what had happened is that the Germans had realised that the aircraft were coming in on a more or less predetermined... It was so dead easy. It was just... We weren't bombing. We were just delivering bombs on the target. And everybody came in the same way, at the same height. And they had a night fighter sitting up. But we'd come in the opposite way. So it was the man in front of us and the man behind us who were shot down. And because we came in the other way, because we were showing Dave what it was all about, We came in the wrong way and missed him.
You went on the bus route?
We went on the bus route. Yeah. So that's what I mean by chance.